2002 was a landmark time for Victoria when three of the world's great champions for the environment came to Melbourne. Doctors David Bellamy, Sylvia Earle and David Suzuki all came to Melbourne to share their views on where we've come in terms of protecting and restoring the environment, where we seem to be heading in the immediate future, and possible consequences if governments and industry don't act to make the environment a high priority. On the morning of Thursday, the 7th of March 2002, Drs. Bellamy, Earle and Suzuki joined Radio Marinara's Bron Burton and David Speller in the 3RRR studios. They spoke about their views on our current attempts to look after the environment, and particularly the marine environment, and talked about their own campaigns to promote positive change in where we all go from here. Good morning to you all, and welcome to 3RRR and to Radio Marinara. Oh,
good morning.
First, a general question. You're all enormously respected for the huge dedication and passion that you've all displayed over the decades in trying to get the message across about looking after the environment. Have your paths crossed often, or has it generally been a solo flight for you in your pursuits and your campaigns?
Not often enough.
You're right.
Well, yeah, we do see each other once in a while. Yes.
It's a small world of campaigners, so you're bound to bump into each other. Anita Roddick is in this part of the world as well, and... You know, I think it's great.
Mm. As we're a marine-focused program, we want to spend some time to talk about your experiences with marine-protected areas around the world, and particularly our current situation in Victoria. I believe you're each aware of the current moves and obstacles to have 5% or 6% of the Victorian coastline reserved as a comprehensive and representative system of marine-protected areas that accounts for all ecosystem types. And I'm interested in your perspective on our current situation, a process that's now in its 13th year. In our attempts to establish a system of marine protected areas, where do we sit within an international context?
Who wants to go first?
Well, lucky 13, isn't it? It must be. It's got to happen. First time I ever saw David Suzuki on television, he was talking about grains of sand on the beach, and I said, wow, why didn't I understand mathematics like this guy? The first time I saw Sylvia was again talking about the thing. And most people see fish dead on the slab in or already cooked, and they don't smile. You get underwater and they smile. And I tell you, when Sylvia gets underwater, and they have big grins on their faces. And this is immense. It's got to happen. Somebody has got to have the guts to say, no take national park in a country. And 13 years, here we are. It's going to happen. I've got my fingers crossed.
Absolutely. I mean, we're here to add our voices to the hundreds, well, nearly 100 organizations here in Australia and tens of thousands of people who already have sort of joined in on and in approving the concept. And it's high time. It's past time, really. If we don't do something now, it's just going to get harder to protect this most important legacy. I mean, the creatures who live along the southern coast of Australia are, well, 90% of them are unique in the world. That's the only place in the world they live. They're as important to Australia, if we really got to know them, the weedy sea dragons, even the sponges, for heaven's sakes. They're gorgeous, and they're unique to not just this part of the world, but to all of the world. Like the koalas and the kangaroos and the kookaburras are on the land, so are these creatures of the sea. They're treasures for all of Australia, for all of the world.
Mm.
I think we face a real problem because we're air-breathing terrestrial animals. We're land creatures, and even if you look at the place that we occupy, the land, we are very, very reluctant to give up any of the land where we see opportunity. So in Canada, for example, we're a huge country with a small population. We set aside less than 6% of the land base for animals and plants to flourish without human interference. Now, you know, humans are one species out of maybe 15 to 30 million species on the planet. And we think it's our God-given right to take over 96, 97% of the land of the planet. Well, when you come to the oceans, it's a total mystery. We're air breathers. This is an alien area. So underneath the oceans, we have no idea what goes on down there. We think it's just water, and so it's kind of homogeneous, and we trash it with drift nets, and we trash it with our trawlers. And boy, are we ever reluctant to set aside anything within that huge area to protect it. Australia, like Canada, has an immense coastal area. And, you know, how much of that coast do we set aside? And we're not even marine creatures. And boy, we don't, in Canada, I think it's less than 0.5% has any protection. And we have the largest marine coastline in the world. And as Sylvia says, there's a universe of creatures down there. We know absolutely nothing about them, what they are, how they interact. And we're trashing them.
How good they are to eat, we know that.
Well, yes, that's right. We're very good at targeting them.
You've all spent significant time travelling and talking to people. What's your opinion with respect to what local people want in terms of marine protection?
I think most people ask, if you ask them the question, what do you fear or look forward to most in the future, they'll say, will my children have a good job, and what sort of environment will they live in? Now, I mean, those things are soluble in economic terms, as long as we put ecology at the base of the economy. That's what's been out of it. They both start with E, and it's the economics of the environment, which now must be down there at the bottom line. But most of the fishers I've met along this coast here, they say, oh, yeah, the fishing was much better, Dave, when I was young. So there they say themselves it's going wrong, and therefore they've got to be part of it in the recuperation, the rehabilitation of these areas. But we must have the local genetic stock. Once that's gone, it's impossible to actually rehabilitate.
Mm. The key is understanding. With knowing comes caring. With caring, there's some hope that we might be able to get it right, find a place for ourselves within the rest of the many species that David Suzuki described that occupy or share the planet with us, or that we share with them. But there's no guarantee that if people understand what's going on that they will care, but I can guarantee that you can't care if you don't know. The magnitude of our ignorance about the ocean is so vast. I mean, less than 5% has been seen at all. But we know enough, after all of the time that humans have been around, we know enough to know that we are utterly and totally, completely dependent on the existence of the ocean for our own survival and our own well-being. Economically, environmentally, all things lead to the ocean. And one thing is also clear, that the ocean now, and I use the word singularly because all the oceans of the world tie together into one ocean, the ocean is in trouble. We have taken so much out of the ocean, especially in the last half century, during the lifetimes of people now around. The changes have been profound, more than during all preceding human history, have been brought to the ocean through our new technologies, our ability to find and extract creatures from the sea at an unprecedented scale. Also, what we're putting into the sea is the other great source of trouble. And again, our capacity to change the chemistry of our life support system, the ocean, through what we allow to flow into it. From the tops of mountains, the headwaters of rivers, from fields and farms, our backyards, even our golf courses, have an impact on what is way downstream. And here's the bottom line. If the ocean is in trouble, so are we. The oceans are in trouble. Ocean is in trouble, and therefore so are we. So what are we going to do about it? Part of the solution, not the entire solution, but a big piece of what is the right thing to do, the positive thing to do, is inherent in this concept of doing just what we did for the land in the 20th century. At least the idea was really born or hatched, and it hasn't really, as David Suzuki points out, it's not enough to really hold the line on the land, but it's the right way to go, to establish parks, preserves, protected areas, not just for the likes of the two Davids here and myself, the tree huggers, the whale huggers, the fish huggers of the world, or for the trees and the critters that live there, but it's for all of humankind forever. It's our life support system that we're establishing some protection for.
I think one of the difficulties you face in the developed world is that we've had huge capital investment in the fishing fleet, and these ships are unbelievably efficient predators. They can, you know, in on the west coast of British Columbia, you can literally take out an entire run with one set of the net because your ability to identify them, locate them, and take them is so immense. So when you've got that amount of money invested in your fleet, it's very, very hard then to pull back because you're involved in competing internationally. The global economy then is demanding that you keep that productivity up. So our experience in British Columbia is that when you get the stakeholders there, they're very, very reluctant to give up any inch of their share. And even the sports fishers who just go out and do it for fun, man, they are one of the most recalcitrant groups going. And they will oppose marine protected areas right down the line. So my suggestion has been that you've got to get communities where they've gone through this argument, where you get fishing people who fought it tooth and nail. But when the MPAs were finally put in place, they became evangelists for it because they could see the concrete results. So I think your community, when there's a bitter debate raging, ought to hear from people who've already gone through it, paid the price, and then reaped the benefit.
I have two last questions. One relates to the bill to establish marine protected areas. It was pulled from the floor at the 11th hour in our last session of Parliament, primarily because of the issue of compensation for commercial fishers who rallied against the parks because they argued that they'd be disadvantaged. Recreational fishers have also been outspoken in their objections, arguing that the right to fish public areas are being taken away from them. And these arguments alone are now threatening to finally sink the attempts of our government to establish marine national parks in Victoria. Looking ahead in time, can I ask you for a response to the question, what's the potential impact of not doing this now? What does it matter if we actually don't get them up?
Well, for a start, the fishers, be they recreational or commercial, won't be able to fish in the future. The stocks are going down, and you ask any of those fishers, would they like their children or their grandchildren to continue fishing? They all say yes, especially the recreational ones. I don't do it, but it's a wonderful way of spending time on the beach, time beside the rivers. And in the past, many of our recreational fishers have been great conservationists. They've been the eyes and the ears of the aquatic sphere, and they've really got to basically follow that up. And we do have the other thing now, under the rules of global GATT, we can no longer subsidise either our farmers or our fishers for production. That becomes a trade barrier. So, we are rejigging the whole of the European agriculture economy so that money, those subsidies, can be taken and used for conservation. So here is a great chance. This is a window of opportunity. And certainly all the fishers along this coast have got to get together and say, we want our grandkids to do it just like we did, but do it properly.
Well, there are other voices that are now being heard, other interests, not just those who like their fish dead, swimming with lemon slices and butter on a plate, but those who love their fish swimming alive and well in the ocean. I mean, the recreational divers, the scientists of the world, while they're in perhaps the minority, so are the fishermen in the greater scheme of things. Most people are just on the sidelines and are not being heard at all. And I wonder, why should fishermen, whether they're commercial or recreational, be selectively advantaged? They think of themselves as being disadvantaged in this, but why should they, and of all the people who should have at least an equal voice in the destiny of the creatures who are out there in the sea, and knowing, as we come to understand, that our health, our wealth, our survival, our well-being relates to what goes on out in the sea, we should recognize that on the balance sheet, along with those whose livelihoods or their recreational time is linked to going out to catching fish and other creatures from the sea. I mean, if we do nothing, if we just have business as usual, the trends right now are blindingly clear. 71-72% of the world's commercial fishing interests are in a state of full exploitation, over-exploitation, or utter collapse. I mean, we're right on the edge right now. The pattern is clear. If we continue as we are, the future looks bleak indeed for those who like to extract fish from the sea. What's being offered here in terms of protecting critical areas in the ocean? My biggest worry is that it's not enough, but at least it's a start. It's a start in the right direction to help restore some of the health to the ocean and stability that we really require. I think that if you think in terms of where we'll be in 25, 50, or 100 years, if we take action now, we will be able to forestall some of the worst events that are inevitable if we continue business as usual.
I think this is really the biggest challenge we face, though. Traditionally, people, since the beginning of time, thought back on their ancestors, thought about what they had inherited from them, and thought ahead to their grandchildren and beyond that. You know, in North America, they speak of the seven generations. You think back on seven generations of your ancestors, seven generations of your children. We don't do that at all anymore. When you think of what the time frame is of the business community, it's not just the annual report now, it's the quarterly report. Mm. That's the bottom line. Mm. That's how far ahead they think. And companies sink or swim on the basis of what their quarterly reports bring in. Governments, look at Australia. Governments can't think beyond 2.5 years. The elections occur every 3 years. That's the extent of long-range planning. And what we're talking about now, we ought to be thinking not just in decades, but in centuries. And people have too short a view. And what happens then is we change the nature of what we're targeting, and then we soon forget what it was like. And we think, oh, this is the normal situation. We adapt to change as it goes. I was born in Vancouver in 1936. When I was a boy in Vancouver, we could fish right off Spanish banks in the middle of the city for halibut. We would catch sea-run cutthroat trout off Stanley Park, fish for sturgeon at the mouth of the Fraser River. My grandchildren now beg me to take them fishing. I can't take them where I went as a child. What kind of a legacy is this that we're leaving? And if we continue with business as usual, you can bet that what we've got now, which is already a diminished marine ecosystem, what we've got now will be a thing of the past very quickly. We've got to think further ahead.
My last question to you is, if you had the Victorian members of Parliament in front of you right now, these are the people who will be asked to vote on whether we establish marine national parks, what would you say to them? What's your message?
Do the right thing and vote them in.
Well, the question is what they want to see as their legacy. Mm. Do they want to do things that will get them reelected or anger a local constituency, a vested interest group? Or do they really want to do something for the benefit of their society in the long run?
Read David Suzuki's latest book. It's full of good news, and actually our policies never hear good news. How the hell can you govern a country if you only hear bad news? There's so much good news out there. Get that on the media, get that into our politics, and they all fall in line.
Gee, thank you, David. I'll pay you later.
It's actually a really good point to actually change the track of this conversation a bit, talking about David Suzuki's book, Good News for a Change. One of the things that activists often get caught up in is the constant day-to-day pushing for change or acting against what's going on. And it becomes fairly disheartening, the fact that you're always pushing against things, and you talk to people, they become disillusioned, they go, oh, it's a waste of time. And often that's because they don't look back and see whether they've achieved anything in the time they've been acting. You guys have been working in environmental areas for quite a number of years. When you look back, do you see that any changes occurred? Have things moved at all, or are you still beating your head against the same brick wall?
My own feeling is that, environmentalism was a word that didn't exist in the early 60s. It took Rachel Carson's Silent Spring to really begin the awareness that we are a part of the natural world and our technological power has repercussions that spread through nature. Certainly, there weren't environment departments. There wasn't concern about environmentalism 30 years ago. There have been enormous changes. The problem is that that's been accompanied by the spectacular growth in industry and global economics. And what we've seen is just the relentless degradation of the planet's life support systems, the air, the water, the soil, and the biodiversity that maintains that. There's a huge juggernaut now rolling over the planet. So at the very time that awareness is rising, we also have this powerful engine that is trashing. And I think that's why there's been that sense of desperation among environmentalists, because we can see so clearly where we're heading.
There's good news and bad news. the bad news in part leads to the good news. That is, the destruction of much of the natural world that has taken place in our lifetime has created a sense of urgency and awareness that has led to a beginning, at least, of a change of attitude and an awareness that we are dependent on these natural systems. And to the extent that we trash them, we trash our future. in my lifetime, there has been, I guess, greater knowledge, greater discovery, greater understanding of the world at an accelerating pace, more learned in the last 25 or 30 years than during all preceding history about the ocean. At the same time, more has been lost than during all preceding human history. But the good news is that in the same time frame, the whole concept of marine parks has come into focus, and protective measures otherwise, because there was the attitude in the 60s that the ocean is so vast, so resilient, so capable of accepting what we put in and what we and able to yield what we take out, that no worries, you know, we can get away with whatever we want. What has come into clear focus, although not widely accepted by everyone, and again it's a matter of knowing, is that there are limits to what we can get away with. That is, I think, one of the greatest discoveries of all time, that the sea is not infinite in its capacity to allow us to do what we do and still maintain stability, still serve in the way it has for as long as humans have been around as our life support system. Here in Australia, the concept of marine protected areas really has prospered and served as a beacon for the rest of the world. The Great Barrier Reef National Park, Marine Park Authority. I mean, that is the biggest park in the world. And while it's by no means perfect, as time goes on, we see what some of the problems are about multiple use and so on. Everyone has benefited around the world from the experiences here in Australia. And on the southern coast, especially, the experiences gained right here in Australia can be applied. We need to have fully protected areas if the system is going to work at all.
Right at this moment, I'm more optimistic than I've been for a long time, and this started about 5 years ago, because the Green Renaissance is actually happening. All over the world, there are groups of people actually beginning to smile, because they see that the baddies aren't smiling anymore. The message is actually getting through. And, I mean, it's a very exciting thing. In the year 2000, I turned down over 1,400 engagements, took on 423, and 80% of those were fantastically good news. And when you get the people moving and seeing things disappear from their lifestyles, which their parents and their grandparents knew were there, then you've got a movement going. And any government is like Harry Potter now, because they go on, they've got this wand of the Green Renaissance, and they haven't learned to use it properly. They don't have the guts to use it properly. If you've seen the Harry Potter film or read the Harry Potter book, he had to actually learn. Now, they've got to take this wand of the Green Renaissance and point it in the right direction. I always thought it would be a revolution. In fact, the three of us sitting here would one day ride up on our great chargers to the government and say, we're taking over. None of us would actually want the job. But a renaissance, like what the last renaissance did, the most beautiful buildings, and it was backed by very, very rich people. Now, some amazingly rich people are now actually coming behind it. And also, if you look at the stock market, environmental consultancies, both good and bad, unfortunately, going up, and environmental technology. And just down this coast, there is a big wave power machine about to go in the water. I think it's 25 kilowatts, and then it'll be followed by a megawatt machine. These things are happening, so let's grab hold of them. Let's take that wand, give it to your government, say the people are actually behind you. This is the Green Renaissance.
Before you get into world domination and taking over world governments, I'd be interested to know where you actually see the changes happening. If you break up the world into, say, three spheres of community, government, and corporate aspects, is the change happening across the board, or is it in specific areas? How do you see that it's actually happening at the moment, and what's driving that?
This is what we set out to try to find for Good News for a Change, Holly Dressel and I. We wanted to look at all levels, at the individual level, at government, at company and organizations. And to our amazement, in the beginning, we didn't think we'd be able to fill a book. We could have filled volumes. As David says, there is good news happening all over the place and at all levels. And I think at a time when many governments, and certainly in Canada and the United States, are trying to pull back and get rid of all of the kind of legislative control of business, freeing up the private sector. We never needed government more. Government to show leadership. And we need to have government ever watchful on behalf of the public and on behalf of wild ecosystems. Our government tends to say we're broke. And we can't afford to do these things. And I say, what a lot of baloney. You know, we have the private sector talking about the free the marketplace and a free economy. These guys are welfare bums, corporate welfare bums. They're getting massive amounts of government subsidy. Look at the oil industry, the auto industry. Hundreds of billions of dollars in the United States alone are going into supporting these companies that claim they believe in free competition and an open market. Just have to see what's happening today. With Mr. Bush trying to throw up tariff barriers to protect the steel industry. These industries that argue about open markets, in fact, go for all of the handouts they can possibly get. It's a huge amount of money. If you pull that back and said, guys, go sink and swim in the open marketplace. We need this money to do good things for the planet. Think what you could do. And in the United States, that bastion of free enterprise, many of the states now are using taxation very creatively. You tax the things that you don't want, and you give a very powerful incentive then to stop producing waste, stop putting heavy metals into garbage and so on, and you start pulling back and rewarding things that we want. We want more jobs. So those that have salaried employees, you pull back on their taxes. Let's use taxation creatively, and it is being used, not just in the United States, but in Europe and other parts of the world, by governments. We need more of that, and there is money to do it.
According to the FAO, the fishing industry on a global scale is being subsidized on the order of $54 billion U.S. dollars annually. So there's one example, complimenting
right.
David's comments.
Yes. Think if you could take that money and put it into restoration and setting aside reserves, $54 bucks, that's a lot of money.
And right at the other end, I had an email from a group of people in Java, and they said, we just found a new big bat cave. We've estimated there's 650,000 tons of bat guano in there. Can you actually help us set up a sustainable export of bat guano around the world? And I immediately sent my A team out there. We're now getting the first container load, not of bat guano in, but actually of wonderful craft work goods. And then looking at how this bat guano project can go on. And very, very interestingly, during the last war, when the Japanese were in this area, they were using the bat cave for protection, and they actually built special concrete bat caves outside so the bats had somewhere to live, because in their tradition, bats are bringers of good news. So you see, it's all there, and all we've got to do is stir the pot. And when people move, blow the government, when the people move, they actually have to respond.
Much interested, too, in the idea of corporate sustainability. First of all, whether that's an oxymoron, something that you can actually have. Is it possible to have a large corporation that is sustainable? And secondly, a lot of the accolades that are going out to companies who are moving down the track of environmental sustainability are often ones who've been seen as the bad guys. For example, Nike, who have been pilloried for a whole range of reasons, are starting to move towards recyclable shoes, and people are saying this is fantastic. So what do you think of corporate sustainability and the fact that often those, say, for example, petroleum companies and Nike, who were seen previously as the bad guys, are now becoming sort of the leaders or people who are being held up as examples of good practice?
What's happening increasingly is that this polarization that has developed or apparently developed between what one calls the environment and the other side, the economy, is coming to be seen as a continuum. They're flip sides of the same thing. We're all in this together. A sound economy yields, more often than not, a sound environment. As people really understand the relationship, certainly a sound economy is absolutely and utterly dependent on a sound environment. That's just one of those things that is coming into focus, that we have not properly accounted for nature, the costs of pollution, the costs of destruction, the costs of restoration in terms of, and the goods and services that we account for, or at least have accounted for in the past, and even to a large extent now, as free. But we, I believe, with our new understanding of how the world works and how the relationship between the natural world and our own human activities, that it all ties together. And the comments that the two Davids have made about the changes of attitude of big business and little business as well, to recognize that we are a part of nature, not apart from it, and that if we think of them as being separate, we're doomed. So is business.
But the problem, though, is that the conventional economics that's being practiced, in fact, as you say, has externalized the real world.
That's right.
So there is a change coming in corporate understanding, but the basic system within which they function is still fundamentally disconnected, and that's what makes it destructive. You see, on average, in 1995, $1.3 trillion of speculation went on in the stock markets around the world every day. Now, that's 30 times the total daily GDP of all of the industrialized countries in the world. And less than 3% of that speculation that's going on has to do with real things like pork rind and oil and stuff like that. 97% of it is currency speculation. People buying money, selling money, and making more money. Well, in a case like that, money grows far faster than the real world, and if the real world isn't plugged in there, inevitably you're going to trash it. In BC, we have forests that grow at the rate of 2 or 3% a year. Now, you don't have to be a genius to know, if you take only 2 or 3% a year of your forest, you can log it forever and still make money. But if you clear cut it, take the money once, put it in the bank, you'll make 10%. Why should you live on 2 or 3% when money grows faster than trees? The same thing with fish. Why should we take fish at a sustainable level when you massively invest in your equipment? Take what you can out of the sea and put it in computers or genetic engineering, and that money will continue to grow, and you don't really care whether you've trashed the marine organisms. So the problem is, unless we connect the economy with the real world,
absolutely,
then it seems to me there's always going to be that disconnect, and the economy is going to be destructive. So in spite of all the nice things, and I must admit, in the book, I give credit when these companies are trying to do the good things. Yes, Nike took a hell of a publicity hit when it was discovered they were making their shoes in sweatshops in Asia, and this is a PR spin. But if it's a good thing, if they've set up an environment group, and they're trying to make shoes that now can be totally recycled, you have to give them credit. Same way with BP and Shell. These guys are in the business of oil, and when you look at Shell in Nigeria, they're doing criminal activity there. At the same time, they have invested massively in what we know is the technology of the future. You've got to give them credit, even though they haven't got it all put together.
Look at both ends of the line, Nike at one end and Tradecraft, which is a fair trading operation working around the world. They both came up against the same barrier. They found they were employing children. Most trade goods are made in villages by children. They all work, and children had worked for a long, long time in village communities. And they both found that, you know, if they took that jobs away, that was the main income for these people. So they had to face up to this. And if you look at Nike's, latest environmental report, they're looking into this sort of management. And you come down here to the coast, you've got P&O. They own 5 of the best resorts up there on the Barrier Reef. And the legislation, the things they have to do, and they try to do them. While at the same time, you've got the Queensland government trashing the ecosystem, pouring nutrients into the Barrier Reef, and a third of the Barrier Reef is dying. So it is beginning. And I don't mind whether it begins from the richest country in the world or the poorest community in the world. These things will come together, and that magic wand will be waved. It's going to happen right here along this coast now.